ahead and grab
one. Free?
Yes, absolutely.
Since they're printed, I'll take one.
All right. It's got all the sessions in it.
I have all electronic medicine.
Help yourself. They're free.
I have one.
Okay. These are the schedules. They're all free.
Great. Yeah. Thank you.
Uh-huh. Hi.
I had a quick question.
Yes.
How are you recording in Old Main? Is it upstairs in the booth from the speakers?
Yeah. Yep.
Because they didn't set up enough microphones, and so the moderator was sort of standing in front speaking very loud. But
really? Wow. Wow, that's strange.
There are only two microphones up there.
Okay.
And so it's shared between the four panelists. But not. So you might want to.
Well, I
give them a little poke. I mean,
yeah.
For that one, it's done. We still have 4 days.
Yeah, and that they have each speaker has his own microphone up here.
Oh yeah, yeah. That was just about me. Yeah, I'll go.
Yeah, that's not us. That's a different company that they hire. I think that's one where they have a truck out in back, a white truck, and that guy is just a fair to work.
Wait, that's
with.
For Mackie, isn't it?
Is that Mackie?
Yeah, that's okay. Mackie. Old Main is a little booth up top, I think.
Yeah, yeah. You got an elevator and then up there and then climb up some stairs.
Yep, yep.
Man, with a $1 million, probably almost $300-400 million facility in that little cage up there. It's like,
yep. All right, I'll go tell them upstairs. Because, yes, I saw he was doing that. I said, like, you're probably not picking him up unless the microphones are sensitive enough to.
Or unless they pull the mic over.
Well, yeah,
slide it over.
He didn't do that.
That figures.
He just got protected.
I know the first session that we did. Are you talking about the first session over there?
No, the one I just came from.
Oh, the one you just came from.
Wow. But I assume there's only two. I can't imagine there were three mics and they took one away. So.
No, I can't imagine that either. Well, I got to go.
Right.
I'm plugged in the system on all of these up there.
Right.
So it's really good.
Okay, so we have everybody?
Yeah.
where our audio people are. This says so.
Does it see?
No, it's so.
Hello?
Huh. All right. Thank you.
I'm going third. She's going second. That's good.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that. Oh, thank you.
Oh, I should move over. The moderator. Okay. Oh, hey, how are you doing?
Good. Good to see you.
Give you a hug if I put
it on. Yeah, okay. Yeah, it was easy. Yeah, yeah. I'm a little maybe in front of you. Yeah.
We'll go picture at the end. Okay. I make everyone do that.
So will you take some too and text them to me later?
What?
Will you take a picture or two and text it to me later?
Yeah.
Oh, do you? Okay, great. They're not messing around. So.
Yeah, I hope they have a
question. Yeah. This is a pretty lively room. It's close to the owning. It's a good layout, I think, you know? Okay. Posted. One fact, so you should have at least one. Oh, already. Huh. Wow, okay.
Yeah.
I was here for the last year of that.
Did they do that?
Yeah. Yeah. They get a little uncomfortable sometimes.
The strangest thing that
sure.
Oh, fun. Right. Right. Oh, I'm sure. Right. Right. Tell me your name.
Nice to meet you, Pam.
All right.
Joseph over there?
one of the things says
Joe. I can't remember Joe's last name. Okay. Jill McNall, psychiatrist.
She's, oh, Jill!
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Jill's great.
I don't know her very well, but she's over in
Portland. Oh, right. She's awesome. Yeah, great. I mean, a great person, also a great person.
Yeah.
Yeah. Busy time of year. I remember the.
Yeah,
it all built up.
Yeah,
it's
very good.
Right?
It's kind of been like that from here.
That's a natural thing, right?
It is everywhere.
Yeah. Like, so go to the Conference on World Affairs. Google that. Click on that. And then go to the upper right once you get on that.
University of Indianapolis.
Yeah.
So that
upper right corner has sort of the lines there. See that? No, you're on the
Google
Conference
on
World.
Get out of that.
That's
great.
Great.
Yeah. And University of
Colorado. Google Conference on World Affairs.
Yeah.
UNC.
Oh, yeah?
Yep.
Up the Greeley?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Over a state. It was more of an agricultural community, purely.
Yeah.
Point.
Yeah.
No,
this is a really dumb question, but how am I pronouncing? I'm not familiar with this at all, so
Miller
kind of
Ross is smarter than me.
That's Ross.
Can we ask you a quick question? That last word.
Last word?
How do you pronounce that?
What are you asking?
I've never seen that word.
I
wonder if it's a
A-N-O-F-I-E.
Don't ask that one.
I won't.
You know what?
No,
yeah. Did you see it? Okay, so live streaming, not live.
Yeah,
sure.
Good press.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Right, that's a whole caseload thing. Yeah. I talked to Jill one time. I was like, I feel like this could be a small series.
We're 235.
Collaboration with mental health clinics. Be like,
but I'm not on the
mental health clinics.
Yeah, we're
doing
mental health care,
the link to the website, and the email that we're
all in. Which is in the moment. So us, Orangeburg, the Rec Center, Full Love, we're all going to be there.
Cool, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. Some from memory, it's not very uncomfortable. For you know, you should know, but you know.
Can I get started?
I think so.
Welcome, everyone. We're going to get started in just a moment, so please take your seats. All right, we'll go ahead and get started. Welcome, everyone. Can you hear me okay? Okay, great. Today is Tuesday, April 9th, 2019. It is 3 o'clock, and this is panel number 1502, entitled Loneliness. My name is Emily Dubash, and I will be the moderator today. I'm a clinical psychologist. I work over at CAPS here at CU Boulder. And would like to begin by first thanking everyone for coming today. This is a packed room, and that's really exciting to see. I think this is a very important topic, and appreciate you all taking the time to come out today and hear from our panelists about this very broad and very important and under-discussed topic. So I'd like to start by introducing our panelists, and I'll start down on, I think it'll be your left side. First, we have Charlie Vanderhorst. He is a emeritus professor of medicine and infectious diseases at the University of Northern North Carolina, Chapel Hill. His career encompassed clinical medicine, National Institutes of Health-funded clinical research, teaching, and implementing clinical and research programs. From 1986 to 2000, his focus was on the U.S. AIDS epidemic. From 2001 to 2015, the AIDS epidemic in Malawi and South Africa. Dr. Vanderhorst serves as a volunteer primary care physician at a free clinic in Raleigh, North Carolina. He is also a senior consultant to Equip Health in Johannesburg, where he helps implement HIV and hepatitis C treatment and prevention programs. And he's also senior advisor to the UNC Johns Hopkins Morehouse Tulane Fogarty Global Health Fellows Consortium. Wow. Dr. Vanderhorst and his team have published 186 peer-reviewed papers, etc. Welcome. We appreciate you being here. Our next panelist today is Miana Bryant. She graduated from East Carolina University with a Bachelor's of Arts in Psychology and Criminal Justice. She intends to pursue her master's and PhD in forensic psychology and work towards becoming a criminal psychologist. Ms. Bryant's passion for mental health stemmed from her own personal battles with depression and anxiety throughout her adolescence, and she turned her own pain into helping others in forming the mental elephant in order to reach other people around the globe who battle with similar problems. She is the sole founder and editor of all online outlets, and aside from her online work, she's also the president of the Mental Elephant Organization on her college campus. And then last, she received the 2017-2018 Black Excellence Award for Black Girl Magic by ECU's chapter of the NAACP, and is an inducted member of the National Society of Leadership and Success. Welcome. Next, we have Mr. Ross Chapin. He's an architect, neighborhood planner, and author based near Seattle, Washington. He is a passionate advocate for sensibly sized homes and socially scaled neighborhoods that nourish the individual, support healthy household relationships, and foster a meaningful sense of community. Since 1997, he has partnered in building 7 pocket neighborhoods and designed dozens of socially oriented communities for developers across North America. He wrote a book, Pocket Neighborhoods, Creating Small-Scale Community in a Large-Scale World, and has shifted the thinking of developers, policymakers, architects, home buyers, and community advocates alike. In his home community, he helped formulate the Cottage Housing Development Zoning Ordinance, and this was the first of its kind to be implemented in the United States. And last but not least, we have Tai Toshiro. He is an author, speaker, and social scientist. He received his PhD in psychology from the University of Minnesota and has been an award-winning professor at University of Maryland and University of Colorado. His first book about the science of choosing a great long-term mate was titled The Science of Happily Ever After. He's also the author of Awkward, The Science of Why We're Socially Awkward and Why That's Awesome, in which he explains why some of the characteristics that make people feel socially awkward can also be traits that propel them towards extraordinary achievements. He's been featured in numerous media outlets, including the New York Times, The Atlantic Times, NPR, and SiriusXM Stars. Welcome, panelists. So now I'll invite you each to take about 5 minutes to share your opening remarks, and then after that point, we will start inviting questions. So I'll let you start it, Charlie.
Thank you all for coming out. I'm going to talk about what are the problems that result from loneliness, what are the causes of loneliness from my perspective, and then maybe some suggestions. First of all, one of the reasons I'm on this panel, because I'm obviously not an expert on loneliness besides being a human being, is that I myself had a suicidal depression in 2014, 2015, and I wrote a column about it a year ago that went viral, and then we had tried to have a panel on it last year that went, those of you who went to it, it went awry because the moderator hijacked it. The thing. It was terrible, wasn't it? Oh, God.
I'll try my best to stay out of the way.
You'll notice he's not back this year. So anyways, so I had my own issues. And the problem is, of course, is that
depression pulls you away from people. You have this inner dialogue going well. And as a male, you think, we can deal with this. I can deal with this, right? Just put on a band and go. And the other thing is that you don't tell other people. And outwardly, everything looks fine. So someone can be isolated, depressed, suicidal, and you don't have the vaguest idea, which was true of a woman who I was happening to me, and my wife was sleeping next to me every night, and it wasn't until every night I was waking up screaming with a nightmare that my boss was stabbing me to death that she realized something wasn't quite right. But it was not her fault, it was my issue. So it's a problem. And just so, what are some of the effects of this loneliness and depression? So depression, 10 million Americans each year have such a severe depression that they're unable to work, care for children, family members, etc. 2 million people over the age of 65 have that. And for the older folks, it can be a death of a spouse, it can be retirement, it can be an illness that throws them off their loop. Addiction is another issue, and we know that there are 20 million people in the United States who are addicted to some substance, either illicit drugs or alcohol. And of those, 8.5 million people also suffer from a mental illness, so they're basically treating their mental illness with the alcohol or the drugs. We know alcohol among elderly, 2.5 million folks over the age of 65 drink to excess. It accelerates dementia. It leads to alcohol is a depressant itself, so it makes depression worse. And it increases falls, which many people over 65 know that's often a death sentence. Suicide's the 10th leading cause of death in the United States, 50,000 deaths every year, 1.4 million attempts, and you all know about the mass shootings that often come from lonely kids or young men. 340 mass shootings in 2018. So what are some of the causes? And this is on no particular order, gated communities. The most ridiculous concept I've ever heard, and I hope you talk about it. Gated communities. Who are you protecting yourself from? Illness, aging, children moving away causes isolation, loneliness, spouses not speaking to each other, taking each other for granted, parents not talking with children. Of course, the children, all they see are the tops of their foreheads and their thumbs because they're on their smartphones. Social media, we may be friends with people, but are we really friends with them? And then there are the various marginalized groups who are isolated, often deliberately, by the rest of society. So gay and transgender youth, who are they going to turn to? An adolescent who decides that they might be transgender or gay, they can't talk to their pastor, they can't talk to their parents, they can't talk to their siblings, to their friends, etc. So that can lead to terrible loneliness. And then we have this new segregation. We've resegregated. We're segregated by church, schools. The charter schools are now completely resegregating the United States, the statistics, and class. We're segregating by class as well. You know, people don't fit in by their race, by their interests, by their looks, by their language. And the current political divide, I think, it's the herd segregation. We all talk to each other and don't listen. We're in this echo chamber. So we no longer see the value, I think, of a shared experience, a shared responsibility. So, you know, the recent college admissions scandal was, you know, a good example of that. So here were these people. They were so concerned over their already smart kids that they completely ignored the social order, spending hundreds of thousands of dollars. And these were smart people, okay? They had the resources to do it and corrupted the whole thing. So, you know, how does their kids feel about that? So that this lack of empathy with the rest of the community. So they're thinking only of their own child, but not of the other children who are trying to get into school. Some suggestions for the young. What helped me as a young boy were my teachers. I had great teachers, and they noticed when things were awry and called me out. Sports teams I've always found are very useful. Other groups, Religion has helped for some people, even though I'm not a big fan of fraternities and sororities. It can help in some ways. I think there should be social workers in certainly in every high school and hopefully in middle schools as well. They're going to notice things. That's what social workers do, and find these isolated kids. And as a physician, 15 minutes with a patient won't cut it. You can't do anything in 15 minutes. So, but as a volunteer, I spend get an hour with a patient. So I can identify when they're lonely, when they're depressed, and I can help them with that. But the payment system, of course, for paid doctors doesn't favor that. You get paid for doing a procedure. I can stick a big tube up your ass, but God forbid I should talk to you for longer than 10 minutes and find out that you're isolated and depressed or shooting drugs. So, building, but there are, to diagnose depression, there are, many of you heard me talk before about PHQ 3 and 9. These are, you can download it on the internet and just ask a series of questions. It identifies people who are depressed. There are 5 questions to identify people who are suicidal. And if they respond at a certain level, then you know you need to get them in, and clinicians can do that. Secretaries can ask those questions. We need more social housing, co-housing movement, kibbutzim in Israel, where you have old and young and grandchildren living together, 3 generations, 1 house. Put a tiny house in your backyard for your single child, and then you can move it into when they marry and they have their own children. And then social media downtime. There are apps now that you can download that will block you from your own social media. And, you know, do it. My daughter told us when we were all sitting down at dinner with a group of friends, cell phones on the dinner table. Collect them, get rid of them. Social media should not be in the bedroom. You're not going to sleep. If you wake up at night, and you will not fall back asleep if your cell phone's there. So it shouldn't be in there. And God forbid you text while you're having sex. It's not a good thing. It doesn't go over well.
All right. On that note, Miana, your turn. Okay, well, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Miana Bryant. As the lovely woman stated, I'm the president and founder of The Mental Elephant. We are a mental health nonprofit organization currently based on the East Coast, mainly in D.C. and North Carolina. And we provide resources to youth and students, college students, or any type of students that may battle a mental illness or maybe feeling kind of weird or kind of down or feeling different and not really know what's going on, or maybe feeling lonely and not really know what's going on. The purpose of our organization is to provide those resources and to provide the support system and to provide the background that a lot of youth and a lot of college students and young adults need that they don't know much about. So I would definitely say that on the panel, I'm here to represent, from not to offend anyone, but from looking around the room, I'm here to represent the smaller portion of people, just kind of the young adults and the kids and the students and just a lot of people that a lot of people assume, especially parents assume, oh, well, you don't have bills and you don't have a hard-working job like I do. You're not working 9-to-5, so why are you stressed? Why are you depressed? Why are you going through anything? And it's like, yes, they don't have a 9-to-5 and they don't have bills, but in the same time, for one, they have you telling them about your bills. They have school. They have their friendships. Like, who in here remembers being in school and maybe not getting invited to a really big party that everyone was talking about? To your parents, it's like, dude, it's a party. Like, you need to be doing your chores anyway. But to you, it's still like, it's an end-of-the-world thing. So I definitely want to be here to represent a lot of the people that, to me, have a voice that has been quieted down over the years because it's kind of like you should be happy with what you have. And it's like, yes, I'm very happy with what I have. However, I know that mentally I'm not as happy as I should be because of these other things that are going on in my life. So I want to
have resources, have the support system, have somebody to check on me when I haven't been to class in 2 days, have somebody to make sure I'm still doing okay when I haven't talked to my mom and my mom is calling me, but I don't want to call her back because then she's going to think something's wrong and then I got to go home. Like, I definitely want to be here to speak for the people that do not have much of a voice and definitely need somebody to kind of be there, like, you're not by yourself. Everybody, I told my mama I wasn't going to cry. Sorry, Mom. Everybody experiences downtime. I can guarantee you there is nobody on this earth that is 100% happy-go-lucky, popping off the walls 24/7 every single day. Everybody has some type of issues. Everybody has some type of problems. Everybody has some type of wall in their mind, whether it's depression, anxiety, change, or schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. There's a lot of different things, but not necessarily saying everyone has a mental illness, because, no, I definitely would say that we overdiagnose in this generation. But I will say that everyone has their own personal issues. Everyone has their own thing that they have to deal with and that they have to wake up and put on their back and try to throw a smile on and go throughout the world to handle. So it's nice for people to just kind of stop and just kind of talk to you and just kind of ask, like, okay, well, what's going on? Well, what's happening? And, well, what's going on with your son? Well, what's going on with your kids? And just to actually talk and feel the support system and feel the help and the love that a lot of people really, 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 really need. Yeah.
Thank you. Ross?
I think we're out of order. Sorry. Yeah. That's a great point because there's a big study done in the UK recently. It was one of the better conducted studies on loneliness, and they found that older adults had a rate of loneliness of 27%, but Gen Zers had a rate of 40%, actually. It's a misconception sometimes that older adults, although their rates are higher than other age groups, it's actually teens and young adults that have the highest rates of loneliness, particularly young men. And we can talk about that a little bit more, but I really like that point. I wanted to just give a little context, evolutionary psychology context, about why loneliness hurts so badly. Humans, it's easy to forget, right? But humans made a huge bet on being social animals. We made this bet that farming together or hunting together, gathering together, child-rearing together would pay off more, each individual would get more than if we were completely self-interested. Now, that's a big bet because if someone cheats, right, now you're in a lot of trouble. If someone betrays you, now you're in a lot of trouble. And so our brains evolve this amazing social machinery. It's rare in neuroscience to see an isolated part of the brain do one thing. Now, some of the pop press will make you think that just one part of your brain is responsible for your hunger or for your interest in drugs, whatever else. It's multiple regions acting in concert. When it comes to social activity, though, one of the weird things that neuroscience finds is that we have isolated areas, particularly specialized for things like perceiving faces and the emotions people might be feeling. We have specialized areas for thinking about how to solve social problems. When you solve a puzzle or a math problem or a science problem, you use an entirely different region of your brain. This tells you how important it is that humans have social relationships and that those social relationships pay off. So, if we get signals from our social environment that things aren't working out, it's a particularly powerful signal. I wrote this book about awkwardness, which I would joke around with friends and family that it was going to be my memoir. I thought I was joking. They were just not like, that makes perfect sense that you would do that. It was one of the more gratifying things I think I've done professionally. And one of the things I had to reconcile with was thinking about, why is the case? Now, an awkward moment, you've all had them, right? An awkward moment is simply a deviation from a very minor social expectation. You know, not having spinach between your front teeth, that's a very minor social expectation. Having your zipper zipped, that's a very minor. No one's going to get hurt. You know, nothing bad's going to happen if it's not. But boy, when it happens, it's a big deal, right? And you are mortified. Your heart starts to race. Your muscles tense. And sometimes we even blush, and you think, I just made it worse because I blushed, you know, and now everybody knows. Well, everybody knew anyways, your zipper was undone, so don't worry about that. And I love blushing, actually, as a little example. Because they find in laboratory studies that people who commit a social faux pas and then blush are actually much better liked, and people actually want to be friends with them after the study, more so than somebody who didn't commit a social faux pas. And that's because you're conveying reflexively, I messed up, my bad, I'm sorry about that, and I'm going to try to fix it. Okay? So there's all of these physiological things and psychological things that are baked into us as much as something can be baked into you. And so when we feel the pang of loneliness, it is particularly powerful. Just like an awkward moment causes this really spastic reaction, the pang of loneliness causes this really visceral feeling in the pit of your stomach, doesn't it? And it causes this kind of panic, even if it's a small thing, like not being invited to a party. It is a huge, huge deal. So it's nothing to be taken lightly, and it's growing, right? And a lot of the data is actually, I'm not going to get into it too much because it's pretty depressing, but some of the large poll data suggest the following. 1 in 4 people in the United States feel that they have no one to talk to about things that are important. 1 in 5 people in the United States say they have no or very few meaningful relationships. Now, you need at least 3 or 4 close, psychologists know this, you need at least 3 or 4 close relationships. If you don't have those, these kind of meaningful, close, tight relationships, you're now at risk for all kinds of health concerns. And they're numerous. Immunological, cardiovascular, mortality, you kind of go down the list of things, and it creates all this risk, and as well as risk for mental illness. So it's a serious problem. It's nothing to be taken lightly, and I'm really glad we're here today to discuss it. I've run out of time, but we can also talk about loneliness when it comes to romantic relationships. If people have questions about that, that's a whole other ball of wax that is really interesting and fast-changing.
Well, I'm thrilled to be on the panel with these folks from different perspectives. There's a lot to take in, and all of you as well, with your questions. So I attend a number of conferences for developers and architects and policymakers in the planning world, and I was at a supposedly leading-edge conference on housing, elderly housing, and where the baby boomer is going to be and what to do. And I was last up on a big panel about all of this, and everyone was there talking about the great advances in technology for, you know, the beepers that the elders can have on and the different signals around the house and smart homes and all of these great whiz-bang things that are going to help us out, that are helping us out, and they do help us out. And I said, well, I've got all the gadgets as well, but there's something else that's missing, that we are needing these gadgets because we've got a completely dysfunctional structure of society. We have, how many years have humans been around? Modern humans, 200,000 years? Okay, the last 60 years where we decided to go without villages, where we decided that development should be these spaghetti bowls out on the ends of things, with no real connections. There are hundreds of thousands of subdivisions over the last 60 years that have been built. Coming in from the airport, oh my God. I haven't been to Denver for a little while, and it's kind of blown me away. But this is normal. This is across every metro region in the country. And so you've got millions of homes that are in subdivisions of these remnants of what we hope to be the American dream, where we've got privacy and independence as the way to go. And they've been created because, one, after World War II, we needed a lot of housing quickly, and so we got into production, and we did it, and we did more of it. And we started feeling perhaps empty, and we started consuming more, and of course, the more consuming that you do, the more that they push on you, and pretty soon we're trying to fill up our lives with extra stuff and bigger plus-sized houses. And you can't buy a house without 2-car garage, maybe 3, and you are coming home from work
frazzled, and you come home through these wide, empty streets, and you go through the garage door, you close the door, and you go to the media room, the kitchen, the refrigerator, and the backyard barbecue. And you might see a neighbor on the weekend if you haven't subbed out the lawn to some immigrant coming in. And so you have no opportunity to have the meetups and the comings and goings. So are we surprised that we're depressed and lonely? The structure of our society is built in. Humans are sociable. We're hardwired for this. And we can't help in small groups but have conversation and tell stories and talk about our challenges and our hopes and our kids and grandkids and our parents and whatever, politics, whatever. It just happens in throughout the day. And yet these opportunities in a day-to-day pattern are missing for a great deal of Western society, certainly in America. A number of years ago, I recognized this, not fully consciously, but I could feel it. Most of my adult life, I've been actually creating right-sized houses, another way of saying smaller houses, right-sized to our lives, the way we fully live, in settings that are more community-like settings. And I saw in our little town sprawl coming our way. I lived with it in Minneapolis, where I grew up in an area where it was in our family since 1900, and it was taken over by suburbia. And it just really struck me. And I saw the same thing happening where I lived near Seattle. And I thought, well, let's help create a zoning code that gives incentives, not the way the prevailing zoning is set up, to do more of the single-family, isolated subdivisions, but to do more infill with smaller homes in a community setting. And so we stepped forward and built one and then another and built them in different places and helped work with policy and zoning. And then I wrote a book called Pocket Neighborhoods about it. And I thought we had the coolest idea and everybody ought to know about it. And so during my research, I was going around and realizing that this is not a new idea. We've been living in small groups, sociable groups, for all of humanity except for the thin little piece at the end of our string of lifespan, where we have not. And so I realized that this is the scale of sociability. And so what I'm working on in my work, 100%, is how we create environments that augment, that foster, that create the scale of sociability in the physical environments that we live in, so that we're supported rather than thwarted to be fully human.
Thank you, panelists. I'd now like to invite you the opportunity to respond to one another's remarks.
Ross, it was interesting to me that the UNC Chapel Hill hired an architect, a young woman, who, when rather than building completely brand new buildings, she reconfigured buildings. She might add on space, but she reconfigured them to create these spaces for people to get together. So connecting two old dorms with, there was previously just space in between, but making a common area that they had to run into each other, the students, and that they could talk and sit and eat and get a latte or something, and the school public health. It was brilliant and it worked. And it had professors talking to graduate students and undergrads. It had graduate students talking to each other and collaborating, and there was the coffee there, and it completely made it a much more warm, welcoming, and less isolating space.
So these are where placemaking makes a big difference. These are the interstitial spaces between, say, the classroom or your research lab, whatever. If you went from your research lab directly to your automobile out on a freeway home, you wouldn't have these opportunities. And so these are places that are the in-betweens where life happens. Where does life happen in the natural world? At the edges, between a forest and a meadow, are these ecosystems where you've got a lot of exchange happening. And so we're creating places of exchange the third places, the pubs, the coffee houses, sidewalks that are wide enough that have sitting places that have lots of things going on. In the housing world, what happened to the porches? So after the air conditioning came in, the porches disappeared. They're not economical. Who needs them? We got the TV. And the porches belong to the street as well as the home. And so the porches are another way in which you've got this interstitial space where just happenstance meetings, meetups. And those happenstance meetups begin to form these thin threads which form these fabrics of connection. And the fabrics of connection hold us in ways that we can't register in the logical mind. They're registering somewhere deeper in our being. It's not only exchange of ideas like we're doing here, but it's exchange of some ground of being human on the, together. So it's the places of connection.
I was wondering about with the mental illness, if it's it seems like it's hard for people to talk about that, and they probably just need the space and someone to be proactive about bringing that up. I'm wondering if you think that we've gotten worse at doing that, or is it the case that there's more awareness and people are disappointed that they can't have those kinds of conversations?
That's actually a pretty good question. I'd probably say in the middle, only because I have noticed, I mean, granted, I'm only 22, so I haven't noticed much in these past 22 years. But I can definitely say from talking to my parents and from the people that I have talked to over the past, like, 20, 30 years, the talk about mental health and mental illness and the stigma around mental health has definitely changed and definitely become more open. But I think in that same breath with social media and, like, things like Wikipedia and things like that where anybody can just say and put anything and can make anything seem like fact or seem like truth, when you also add that into it, when it comes to mental illness, I think that's when you lead into the overdiagnosing and then the people just wanting to throw things around, like kind of, for instance, people just saying, oh, well, yeah, I'm totally bipolar because I wanted ice cream today and yesterday I wanted pizza. And it's like, I think you're just hungry, dear. I don't think that has anything to do with bipolar disorder. I can show you to someone who actually does deal with bipolar disorder, and you can see that what they eat is the furthest thing from their mind. So I think the topic and the conversation has definitely expanded, which is amazing because it is something that needs to be talked about, especially in 2019 with everything that is going on in the world, and especially with everyone able to see anything that happens, good, bad, in between, on their phone, two clicks away, you can see the entire news from the whole world. So I definitely think talking about mental illness and mental health is important and has changed over the years, but it's changed in both lights.
I think we've gotten a better idea on how to screen for it in terms of a public health way of doing it. And I think if you just provide the opportunity, people do. I used to teach the medical students that there are three things, and nursing students, there are three things that patients will spill their guts about and that make their practitioners blush, and it's sex, death, and religion. And if you give patients the opportunity, they'll just spill everything. But I would add mental health. They'll talk if you give them the opportunity. But you have to notice, right? If you walk in the room and you're only thinking of hearts and livers, then you're lost it. But if you walk in the room and you notice that the person, there's something wrong, or if you notice their partner or their child is clearly stressed out, that's when you get the opportunity to say, I need to ask about it. What's going on?
I've got a question that... see if I can form it here. So I have two people in my own family close that have been suffering depression, and I've seen them begin medication, and whoa, this is not the way to go because it's overdone, and then they go the other way, And they finally are finding, I think, some balance. And I'm going, oh, this is really helpful. And they are on their regimen of medication. Now, this is not a world that I know personally. I mean, I get depressed, but not like I've seen this depression. And I'm wondering about how dependent people are and can be on medication, and if there's a disruption in the medication, given glitches in whatever, you know, economy, society, we're looking at longer term, what's happening on our planet, those bigger questions, but it might be something different. What about the disruptions in medication? And are people, if they're on it, are they on it, like ad infinitum, or are there? Is it clear that this is just an interim?
Okay, just before I respond, I just want to say I'm not a doctor at all. I will definitely respond just because I was diagnosed with major depressive disorder and general anxiety. So I literally have Zoloft in my purse right now. So I take medication. I take an antidepressant every single day. I can definitely say over the past 3 years, it has changed my life, and it's changed my outlook, and it's changed how I function as a person on a daily basis by a lot. It makes me a lot more able to function and a lot more able to interact with people without going into panic attacks or without overthinking situations. But I can definitely say, when it comes to me, and especially when it comes to my significant other and my family, the biggest time that they see my depression and they see my anxiety is when I've been on medication and then, like, I run out of refills or I forget them somewhere and then I immediately have to stop. That is the biggest, I can hands down say that is the biggest time that you're going to see, at least from me and at least from the few people that I know, the biggest symptoms. And I guess you guys can definitely tell me if I'm correct, because from what I understand, it's called a serotonin withdrawal, mm-hmm. where you're kind of constantly getting serotonin and you're constantly getting your medication, and then all of a sudden it just stops. And your body just immediately kind of goes back to its normal serotonin levels, which for me personally, once again, not a doctor, for me personally, immediately I'm not hungry. I don't want to talk to anybody. I don't want to be touched. I don't want to talk to my parents. If my mom calls me, I start crying. If my boyfriend comes home late, I'm an angry, violent mess. So I can definitely say, oh, it gets violent. It's violent. Not towards him. Sorry. Mm-hmm. More towards walls and things. But yes, it definitely, being on medication is amazing, and it is something I do suggest to people, but another side of it that a lot of people 100% really need to pay attention to is serotonin withdrawals and is when you do not have access to your medication, because that, for me personally, is when you're going to run into the biggest obstacles and the biggest walls, because your body is so used to running normally and running on this medication and being at this high level, so for you to immediately drop, it's a very drastic change.
So to chime in, the serotonin effect, what she said, this may not be a physician, but she's correct. I would add then, though, that the corollary with that is that we need universal health care. There needs to be parity between mental health and other kinds of health issues, and so that folks can have access to the medicines. There are generic, very good generic medicines now, too. So depression, of course, can be situational. You can have grief, you know, after a spouse dies or something like that, and you can then need, you know, short-term antidepressants. In my own personal situation, it was, I'd been depressed off and on. I'd been off and on antidepressants and had done fine. This was catastrophic. I was making plans to jump off the roof of the hospital. So, and it was so bad that I'm having no side effects from the medicine, so I'm going to stay on it forever. So I think it has to be an individual decision. And with depression, of course, talk therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, mindfulness, things like that are all incredibly helpful. And with those, it's conceivable that you could go off the thing. But it should not be, it's not an antibiotic.
You know, I might say, too, just as far as the shift that occurs when someone goes off their meds, that there's a social component to that as well. There's actual things the meds are doing, but also another part of that is the consistency of waking up in the morning and committing to taking that medication. And there can be a social effect of that as well, where people know that you're taking that medication. Now, when someone's not on it and there's that edginess or seems like the impulse control isn't as good or the various things that can happen, one of the things that happens in places like the United States is people react very poorly to that, something psychologists call expressed emotion. This concept came out of, it's not that you shouldn't express your emotions, but not like this. So a few decades ago, they found that schizophrenic children or teenagers, young adults in India fared much better in their outcomes than schizophrenic young adults in the United States, even though they weren't getting the kind of mental health care they were getting here. So why was that the case? And the variable that popped out in that study, and it's been replicated a number of times now, was that their parents did not freak out. So when the kid was having a delusion or a hallucination, you know, that they were Jesus Christ and they're going to walk on water or whatever else, parents were like, cool. You know, don't go try it, but whatever. Right, fine. In the United States, we totally freak out about that stuff. And we just don't do that for schizophrenia. We do it for depression, anxiety, ADHD, and everything else. And it just makes things so much worse. And it makes the person who's being overreacted to feel like they're not understood or not heard and isolated.
Thank you. At this point, I would like to encourage, we're already getting some questions rolling in, but please feel free. I see there's some producers walking around collecting note cards. If you would like to write down your question, please write legibly so that I can read it. And if you are a student, please write student as we're going to make sure we prioritize those questions.
You can do it by the app, too.
You can also submit it through the app as well. So I can explain that if people have questions about it. No, we're actually doing it a different process. So thank you. So our first question, we are more connected as a society than ever and yet so isolated personally. Why do you think that we continue to propagate the very systems that are responsible for our loneliness instead of moving away from them? So what's driving the real issue?
Duh. Money. I mean, it's just like it sprawl makes money. We have not, disease makes money, right? Think about how much we're spending on supposed health. No, this is disease we're spending on, and we're trying to get better. That's my first take.
I do think that there's a monetary perspective. One of the things you see with loneliness data is that there's a lot of inequality, actually. So people from lower income brackets actually are lonelier than people in middle income brackets. Racial minorities are lonelier than white Americans are. One of the interesting things, though, about this is that once you pass into the top one percentile of income, now your risk rates for loneliness and other things like drug abuse now are equal to people living below the poverty line, especially for teenagers. So there is too much of a good thing, right? But, you know, there's still, this is kind of a recent thing, and they're still sussing out kind of what's happening there. But there's a lot of sterility relationally in some of those homes. And that's, I'm not saying all homes, you know, in that income bracket are that way, but there's more of that on average. And that does drive some additional problems.
Next question. Can you please distinguish the difference between loneliness and a more introverted desire to enjoy being alone?
Okay, all right. And I'm getting quiet. So I got this a little bit with awkward. So awkward's an ability. Like, you just don't understand things. Like, you understand how long to look people in the eye, for example. 3.2 seconds, by the way. You know, you don't understand how far to stand away from somebody. It's 18 inches, by the way. You just don't get some of those things. It's different than introversion. So introversion and shyness, those are preferences. So like awkwardness and introversion are correlated with each other, but they're not perfectly overlapping. And so you have this preference to sit one-on-one with a friend at a coffee shop on a Saturday night and have a deep conversation about something, rather than be at the rager party and talk to everyone for 15 seconds at a time. It's not that one thing is better or worse than the other, it's just you have preferences for these kinds of things. I think sometimes, we were having a conversation earlier before we came in here, I can't remember who I was talking to, and we said, isn't it just nice to think about the idea of coming home sometimes after a hectic day and closing the garage door and not speaking to anybody. In New York City, I can tell you, I really enjoy that sometimes. But I think the thing with loneliness, the important thing I think with loneliness is that it's not the objective number of people you're surrounded by. It is your perception of social connectedness and the availability of that social connectedness that defines loneliness. So I think the worst thing in the world is to be in a large group of people where you think you should be happy, but a particular type of relationship is absent in that situation. And you will feel the worst kind of loneliness possible in those situations. Because you say, I'm surrounded by people, but the kind of emotional fulfillment I want is not available to me. And that's really what it hinges on. So there's differences, subtle differences between these things, and I think it's important to keep in mind, because sometimes people think that being introvert or shy is a bad thing, and it's not, you know?
Okay, this next question is for Ross. What most persuasive point would you make to city council and the community to encourage house size restrictions and encourage co-op community lifestyle in, incentives?
I like not to have restrictions or edges like that. I think that it's better to have choices. Right now, the choices are very minimal. And they're very minimal toward a certain kind of household, a family-sized white household prevailing in America. And I think that if we take a look around at what a healthy community is, then there have to be places for all of us. And so if the zoning can allow for places that have affordability for students and people just getting out on their own, or for the single widow, or the empty nester who doesn't need or want to be isolated out on the end of a cul-de-sac with nobody around. That we need places that are urban, we need places that are at the center, we need places that are at the middle, we need places that are diverse in terms of types. So I somehow or another to bring them in. And there's a lot of ways to sneak in density. Right now we're challenged with hundreds of thousands of square miles of just roads so that we can get from one place to another. We need to encourage walkability. But that means we need density. And if you come to the elegant density session, we're going to be talking about that. But there's ways to sneak in the elegant density that you hardly even know. A shared house, accessory dwelling unit, different ways like that. So I don't like to see it in you cannot have. I like to say we can have more opportunities for people of our whole community.
This next question is from a student who is planning to work as a resident advisor on the Residence Hall next year. After seeing some of my peers thrive in college and some suffer from loneliness, what advice would you provide to myself and others to facilitate authentic, trustworthy relationships with my peers and future residents?
Hello again. Okay, well, student, I would definitely say probably to stop and think about what makes people seem relatable to you. What do you like to see in other people? What do you like to see in other friends that makes people seem more comfortable and more relatable to you? So I would definitely say to just try to be 100% be yourself. That is hands down the best thing that you can always do. Be yourself. Because even if people don't say it, people can tell, humans can tell when you're not being who you're supposed to be or when you're trying to just drag stuff out or act like a different person. So I would definitely say be yourself and be open. But also listen, which is something I definitely believe a lot of people have an issue with. A lot of people A lot of people can hear. You can tell me something, and of course I can hear it. I can hear it all day, every day. I hear my mama all the time. But it's actually listening and actually comprehending what they're saying and comprehending what their issues are, what they're going through, the type of person that they are, what they do and don't like, so you can form a better and deeper connection with that person and a better relationship with that person based on what you like, what they like, what you all both agree with, and what makes both of you all comfortable versus just social norms and what you all think you should be doing and what you all think you should be talking about.
Another question from a student. What effect does online dating have on people and how they approach dating relationships?
Well, it's not all bad. I'll say that to start. Let me give you a simple algorithm that's actually very powerful. So the best algorithms predict when people will commit to each other or stay committed to each other in a romantic relationship. Is the same algorithm they use over at the business school or the econ department to predict when people will buy and sell their house or their stocks. Okay? So it's just three things. It's what do you want, what do you think you're getting, and what are your what we call attractive alternative options. Perceived attractive alternative options. Okay? And what's happened with online, you can think of how that algorithm works out, right? Now, what's happened with online dating is that the perceived attractive alternative options variable has gone through the ceiling, right? People think that there are thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who are viable attractive alternative options. That is not true. There are millions of people on online dating apps. Not all of them are going to sign up for you, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. But it has, I think, and there's good data to support this, really decreased the rate of commitment. Everyone's saying, and I'm agnostic as to whether or not people get married or not, but millennials are not marrying. Now, their divorce rate has gone down. Divorce rate has gone down for the first time in a long time. Thank you, millennials, for that. Okay, but they're also not marrying at the same rate. They're almost half as likely to marry as baby boomers were by the age of 30. And so you have this kind of awkward phase after, you know, in your mid-20s where you're trying to figure out what to do with that time. And the sociologists are saying, well, they'll just do it later. And I'm not so sure. You know, and I don't know if that's good or bad, but it's this technology has happened so quickly that no one's caught up to it yet. And I think individuals need to take responsibility to figure out what is it that I actually want from my life and how can I use this tool as a piece of the puzzle to facilitate that.
Okay, this next question is also from a student who has already heard of three students who have died by suicide. In your opinion, what is the best course of action to prevent future suicides and help students know that they are not alone?
So, first of all, as I, for those of you who are at the morning session know, the clinicians have a saying that we believe in someone's autonomy, their independence, unless they're a danger to themselves or others. So, you know, I can have a patient who, I'll let them decide, you know, I can yell at them for not taking their diabetes medicine. But if they are making plans to harm themselves, then they have no rights. Then they get hospitalized, and I sit with them until they're in a hospital and can prove that they're no longer suicidal. So, and that goes with children, with parents, with friends, with other. If you're the resident advisor and you think someone's suicidal, you've got experts in, in counseling and CAPS and the college counseling office. And they'll advise you, but you stay with that person until things. So my niece tried to kill herself many years ago, and it was just by the luck of the draw that, you know, she fell out of a upper bunk bed, and by chance her roommates were, suite mates were back in the room during classes, and they heard her fall, and they took her and she was in an ICU. So there, you lose that. So that's one thing. And ask questions is the other thing. So to prevent, most people who try to take their lives are depressed. so you can ask about that, okay? And for suicide, there's a series of five questions. You ask, have you had any thoughts of harming yourself? That's question one. If they say yes, then you ask the second question. And you don't have to be a professional to do this. Anybody could ask that. And the remarkable thing is that suicidal people will answer you truthfully. They don't lie. I don't know why, but they don't. And then the second question you ask, when you have this ideas of harming yourself, have you made any plans to do so? And if they say yes to that, then that's when you need to intervene. And then your third question is, do you have the means to do so? Meaning pills, gun in the house, poison, stuff like that. And then you can't leave them alone, and you need to get them help. So you diagnose depression, that'll prevent it. And you notice and you ask questions, as she said. And then you ask questions about the suicidal ideation and you intervene.
So just to add to that too, as a psychologist who works over at CAPS, just want to put out another plug. We're located in the Center for Community up on the third floor, and we have walk-ins every day between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. as well as an after-hours 24/7 crisis line. I just want to put that out there. As we're talking about this really heavy topic that can trigger a lot for all of us based on our own lived experiences. And again, just to reiterate, for folks who are struggling with these thoughts, know that there's actually a lot of people out there who are having these thoughts. And unfortunately, we're seeing more and more students every year take their own lives and really struggle with severe mental health issues and trauma and PTSD and discrimination and all kinds of issues. And just, I guess for me, I would also just want to put out there, just don't be afraid to ask the question. It's okay if you don't have the answer of what to do, but it's important if you do think that someone is struggling to just not shy away from asking that question, are you having thoughts of suicide? And then listen, and actually listen to what they tell you and not, you know, give the impression that you don't want to hear them say yes. And so there's all different methods and ways to do that, but if I could just emphasize one take-home point today, it's just to ask a person and then to really thank them for sharing with you, for having the courage to come forward and to tell you what their answer is and to say, I don't have all the answers, but I want to help you figure out a plan and we can do this together to get you some help. So that's just one other plug I want to put in there. And now I'll back away.
That's good. I'm glad you did that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we've got just about 10 minutes left, and I'm getting lots of questions. I'm just going to sort through them for a moment. Another one that we received, please discuss the difference between loneliness and depression. Can you be lonely without being depressed or vice versa?
Very hard, yes. There are people that suffer extreme depression, and they have 6, 7, 8, 9 siblings, so... It technically it depends on what your definition of loneliness is, but being depressed does not necessarily mean that you're lonely, and being lonely does not immediately mean that you are depressed. It depends, and I think each situation depends on the person. Depression is a very big word, and it's very easy to throw it around with a lot of things, but depression at the end of the day is a person-by-person situation. Nobody's depression is the same as somebody else's. So... to answer your question, it's like there is a difference. I'm not sure if I'm the greatest person to explain the difference, but from the person that has to deal with the two situations, yes, there is a very, very, very big difference.
Next question. This one's for Ty. Can you speak more about relationship loneliness? How does one go about not feeling as lonely while being single?
Well, if it helps, there's more single people in the U.S. than ever before. So you're not alone. In fact, it tipped over 50%. Now, it's for two reasons. One, because people are marrying later, and two, because there were the divorce rates and so forth, and so that keeps people single. Also, it's the case that people are living in single person apartments more than ever before, single person houses more than ever before. So it can get pretty quiet, right, and get pretty lonely. And you add on top of that the online dating, where everyone thinks they have 10,000 attractive alternative options available to them, and it's not a great setup, you know. That's the discouraging stuff. That's the bad news. Now, what's the good news? I think that one of the great variables out there that's undervalued in the dating market. So if we moneyball this a little bit, okay? One of the things that people undervalue is kindness and empathy. People who will listen, for example. I don't know why they undervalue that. Well, I know why, but you shouldn't. It is actually one of the most important things for a relationship. And if you look at longitudinal data where they catch people before they were married and they track them 20, 30 years later, and they say, well, how successful were the relationships as far as how happy are they and how happy is their partner, important, and how likely were they to stay together? Having somebody who's kind and empathic and listens to you is a huge deal. Because it's based, the mentality is totally different. And so this is what you're looking for, okay? In the midst of all these hard things, this is what you're looking for. You're looking for someone who makes the bet that this is not a zero-sum game, that I do something nice for you and you do something nice for me. You want to find somebody who trusts that it will be equitable across decades, right? So you have your bad years. That's horrifying for young people to hear. But if you hear these interviews with really happy couples who've been married for 50, 60 years, they'll talk about the bad years, plural. That is unfathomable to me. that's what happens, right? And when you have this idea that you'll just give freely, it, of course, grows the value in the relationship exponentially. If I had to say there's one secret to the couples that find the happily ever after and those that don't, it's that.
Thank you. Next question. There is a lot of talk about aging in place. Given the large proportion of the population who will be 65 and older in the next several years, what support services can we provide to prevent social isolation and loneliness while also accommodating the desire to live independently?
Let me jump in on that one. There's a group, my name, Brand, just appeared. It's the Neighbor to Neighbor connection. Beacon Hill started it out near Boston. And it's independently people coming together, volunteering to offer whatever services, to receive whatever they need, to draw upon the skills and resources of plumbers and electricians and fix-it people all around. So that's one thing. On my island, I live on Whidbey Island, there's something called Hearts and Hammers. And every 5th of May, 400 to 500 people in the community come together and support. And they come together and they support people to get their homes together so they can age in place and have the support that they need. Beyond that, we have another organization in our community called Healing Circles. And Healing Circles has just begun to launch something that can be generic for other communities. And it's a way in which one-on-one small circles come together of people of needs, people that are grieving, people that are have spouses or they themselves have serious illness, and they come together in circles to listen, to share their stories, to be together. So those are a couple of things that I would offer. One more thing, excuse me. Aging in place, everybody's thinking, we got to age in place. I think we got to age in community. And there's a lot more on that one.
Got just a few moments left. What is the future of loneliness?
I think you would have to expand on your question.
You know, if we come together, I mean, my point being that that I'm worried about the sort of lack of empathy and lack of community and where everyone is an other and we're not in this boat together, I think that's what's bad. If we, you know, it's trite, but I'd like a little more kumbaya. and that we come together and realize we have this shared responsibility for others in our community, from the lonely folks, from the elderly, for the single moms, you know. If we came together and saw everybody as a human being worthy of our empathy and love, we'd be better off. And I think this is a, we're in a, from my perspective, we're in a dark time now. And I think there is going to be a light at the end of the tunnel. And I think people will come together. And we've seen it in other societies where they've done that. And so I think there is hope.
I don't want to step in too much here, but each one of us are seeds. So I think that the seeds for local community making. And so will there be more loneliness? Yes. Will there be less loneliness? Yes. In pockets. And if each of us take the initiative in our own lives to be a seed of conversation, a seed of kindness, a seed of being together, a seed of reaching out when you feel the strength to reach out and to be present. And so when I take a look around, I am hopeful. I'm seeing 100, 150 seeds here in our own communities.
I just want to say that I am also optimistic. And I'll tell you who makes me the most optimistic are millennials and Gen Xers, because there's that sensibility of, like, let's put the phones away at dinner, right? There is a sensibility about, hey, all of this stuff is too much, and you Gen Xers and everyone else are kind of messing it up, so we're going to fix this. And I think there's a wisdom there that all of us would do well to listen to, because the digital natives, I think, are the ones who are going to have a better handle on this, and I think they'll actually show us the way.
Last question in the 1 minute remaining. For any panelists, if you could give your past self one piece of advice, maybe when you were a college student, about this topic, what do you wish you could have heard?
Okay, well, since I'm still a grad student, I'd talk to my high school self. The biggest thing that I would probably say is to understand that, yes, you feel lonely, but you're not the only person in the world that feels this way. That loneliness definitely has a way of overtaking you and making you feel like you are literally isolated, the only person in the world that is having a bad day, the only person in the world that feels like this. And something that can definitely help is just to remember, you're not. Like, there's other people in the world that are going through the same thing. And not to mention, because there are other people in the world going through the same thing, that means that out there in the world, there's ways to help it, and there's ways to fight it, and there's ways to fix it, and there's ways to definitely feel better. Yeah.
Thank you. Any other final thoughts? Okay. Well, thank you, everyone. And a round of applause for our panelists. Thank you all for attending.
Can you take a picture of us here with the backdrop?
Hang on.
All right.
Hang on. And you can do one here as well. I'm going to do a picture of all of us.
All right. Thank you. All right. Another one here.
Got it. Thank you.
All right. One more.
All right. Thanks.
Great, thank you.
Good work. Yes. Sure.
Very good.
I hope we run into each other.
That's right.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
It's a good question, I think.
Thank you very much.
Resources on that. Just a lot of long-term relationships pop up in the third decade. And it's a
That is definitely.
Well, just know you're not alone. It's, yeah, you know, but I love the honest stuff. It's real. Like, okay, yeah. Thank you. I appreciate it. Hello?
I'm going to have to ask about Neil Goldman and Anomi. Anomi is a lot of values.
Okay. I've never actually even really looked into that, so thank you for that. That is something I've never even paid
attention to.
I'm right there with you. You know, if you look at the Bowling Alone data from Putnam, Bowling Alone's the book. Bowling Alone. It's a great idea that more Americans bowl alone now than they used to, right? But that data's been updated. It's 2000. The data's been updated. It's still the same argument holds true. So, yeah, exactly. Yep. Hello? How are you? Hi. Hi, how are you? Hey, good to see you. So they're having thoughts that they were more than that. Actually. So they think they're Jesus, or they think they're the president, or they think they're. You're seeing things.
That is a very thing. It definitely sounds like it's really good.
It's very delusional. And it's very anxiety provoking to watch. Because the
because it's easy to call somebody through the phone, but by yourself.
CIA, when it's on the ground. That's what happens in India. The families are much more
calm,
more even emotionally. And it's actually very helpful to the child when it happens. And since then, since those early studies, it's not just for schizophrenia, for depression, for anxiety, for a whole host of things where Alzheimer's? Oh, okay. I didn't think that did. Thank you. This idea that when someone is having a hard time, you don't classify the emotion.
Thank you. It should have. It definitely should have. It might be in another panel.
I recovered, but live a better life. You know, live a better life than I would have otherwise. So, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there are actually indices that compare the different.
Hello.
I'll track it down. But there are. There's cool maps where you can see. Oh, it's going to be captured in the screen. We rank 19, by the way.
Thank you. We're going to see you tomorrow, right?
Hey, look who's here.
I know, two old
hey, Peter. Peter, this is Henry Kroll.
How do you do?
Who's part of Silver Sage. You're going to see him tomorrow morning.
Mr. Kroll!
So he's been a leader in public broadcasting all his life. Yeah. He's one of our leaders in Indivisible. So.
Yeah, very good. I'm looking forward to hearing what's going on with that.
Yes.
How do you know? How long do you know
him? That's an overstatement.
Lovely.
Here. But I'm glad
change.
Thank you. I'm recording all these workshops.
Down and put my table away. Yep. And then go.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to pick it up at night.
No, I'll pick them up tomorrow.
Okay.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
We'll do it every year.
These recorders are closing. When I first got them, I put it right next to the TV and left it on all night. And it ran like 23 hours.
Yeah.
Battery was good and recording was good for 23 hours. Everything.
This is a repeat though, so we can just delete this one.
Yeah.
And then this one is probably, I don't know what that is.
The melt. Yeah, so can we turn that into a wave? Make sure that
yeah.